Blog Talk Radio.
Here we go. There is a sixth dimension beyond that which is known to men. It is a dimension as immense as the sky and as perpetual as eternity. It is the middle ground between illumination and darkness, between knowledge and ignorance. It lies between the depths of man's horror and the apex of his learning. This is a dimension of fantasy. It is an area which we call the Eerie Zone. Perhaps the cheesiest homage you'll ever hear. Good evening and welcome to Eerie House Radio for a very, very special episode. I'm Dale Kay from Spook Show. I'm here with
Dave Binkley from Weirdness Really Bad Movie and Spaceship One. We got a full house here. Up next we have...
This is CW. To help serve up a wonderful homage to Mr. Sterling himself.
Okay. And Gar, go ahead.
I'm in the zone. Blah, blah. It is I, Gar the Ghoul.
And our very special guest. Go ahead and introduce him, Dale.
Oh, sure.
No, go ahead.
Very, very special guest, author Mark Dwidziak. Rejoining us, if you'll recall our special on Kolchak, tonight, he's going to illuminate us with many details of Rod Serling. Welcome, Mark.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a favorite topic, and I'll never run out of things to say about Rod Serling and the Twilight Zone, so fire away.
You wanted to write the Twilight Zone companion, but you said it was already there, right?
That's right. Yeah, I've kind of told the tale till it's gone stale. But yeah, that's exactly the case. Is that when I finished my first book, which was published, everybody get ready for Mark's bones to creak here. 40 years ago, my first book was published in 1982, and when I was finishing up that book, you know, everybody always says the same thing to you when you're finishing up a book and waiting for it to be published, which is, what's your next book going to be? Assuming there's going to be a next book. And I always, the standard answer was, I know exactly what my next book's going to be. I'm going to write the history of the Twilight Zone. Why not? My favorite show of all time. It's somebody needs to do it, but somebody did do it, and somebody was doing it, unbeknownst to me, at that very moment that I was telling everybody that's what I was going to do. I was living in Upper East Tennessee, Southwest Virginia area at the time, and nothing in my brain said to me at that moment, you know, maybe this isn't the best place in the country to write a history of the Twilight Zone. Maybe you're not ideally situated to do this. But sooner or later, I walk into a bookstore around that time, and there it was, staring me right in the face, Mark Scott Sacree's The Twilight Zone Companion, which was and still is one of the best books ever written on a TV show. It is a landmark book for the history of a TV series. It was a model of how to do that kind of a book. So I couldn't even be mad. I couldn't even be angry by the fact that somebody beat me to it, because Mark did such a great job on that book. And I set my sights on another favorite show, Columbo. And the next year, I joined the Akron Beacon Journal as their TV critic and moved to Ohio. And all of a sudden, I was in the perfect place to write, in the perfect job to write a history of a TV series as being a TV critic. It gave me tremendous access. And that book was published in 1989 as The Columbo File. And In the back of my mind, I just always thought, and this is a foolish thought, I'll cop to this, that somewhere I was owed a Twilight Zone book. No, you're not owed a Twilight. Nobody owes you that. Foolish thing. But I had to find a route back to the land of shadow and substance. And little did I know what that route was, because, you know, we all think we're the captains of our ship. We all think we're in command. And you're not. You're not. You know, life pushes you in certain directions. Life pushes you. And you look back at after a while and you see the pattern and go, oh, I was following the course of a river and it brought me here. And that course, to get back to the Twilight Zone, it had to go through Kolchak. because
perhaps you were just walking on the outskirts of the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, well, when I did the Columbo book, I was positioned really to be more in the mystery field than I was in the horror field. I thought my next book was going to be, just as I said it was going to be the Twilight Zone after the first book, after the Columbo book, I got the same question. People said, well, what's your next book going to be? And I said, I know what my next book is going to be. It's going to be about Dashiell Hammett, the author of The Maltese Falcon.
Nice.
I had a handshake deal with a publisher to do that book. And it was all stitched up. And then the stitchings came loose. Because the publisher was sold to Warner Books, and Warner Books said to that press, you're no longer doing nonfiction books. You're only doing fiction books. So I was without a publisher. And it was at that moment that a guy called me with a small press in New York and said, I love your Columbo book. Have you ever thought about doing the same type of book on The Night Stalker, on Kolchak?
Mm.
And I said, oh, I love that series. That's one of the best, great. I just didn't know there was a publisher crazy enough to do that book. And he said, well, I'm crazy enough to do that book. So we did that. That was published in 91 as Night Stalking. Then I ended up writing the first Kolchak novel. In 94, then I ended up redoing and revising that the Kolchak book as the Night Stalker Companion. Then I ended up editing collection off of that, three volumes of work by Richard Matheson, who wrote the teleplays to the Night Stalker and the Night Strangler, and Richard had also been a great contributor to the Twilight Zone.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, without realizing...
He would have the second most scripts for Twilight Zone, only behind Roth himself.
Actually, you know, he and Charles Beaumont were the two major contributors past Rod. They were kind of even up. They were the first two writers recruited for it, and they were very close friends. But, anyway, then I did a book on Dracula. And what I didn't realize was I was working my way back to the Twilight Zone the whole time. You know, that by the time the idea came to me to do everything I need to know I learned in the Twilight Zone, I had already built up all the credits that I needed in the fantasy and horror field to do that book for St. Martin's, and then the exact right idea occurred to me on how to do a Twilight Zone book that nobody else had done, which was to treat the episodes as parables, as morality tales.
They are.
And the fact that you could, yeah, and that's exactly what they are. And
yeah, you have
I
to admit
sort of
that,
got that
that
idea.
You have to admit you gotta wish that some people would follow some of those morals these days.
The signpost up ahead. Each signpost is a guide to how you should live your life. That's exactly what they are. Each episode is a signpost up ahead.
For our listeners' sake, who's joining us?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Tim Ahrens. I'm the author of Dark Creatures. I'm
oh,
also
back,
a Twilight
Tim.
Zone fan. So I had to tune into this one.
I was confused. I was like, how many people are on this call?
I was wondering about that, but with blog talk, one
like,
never knows.
I just kind of
it's the eerie
it,
zone. The eerie zone has struck. When I find I'm the captain of my own ship, that's when I'm determined I'm on the wrong boat. You know what I'm saying?
I'm married and I am a captain of my ship as long as I have my wife's permission to say so.
I'm a captain of my ship as long as it's stinking. Mark, I got a question for you if you're up for questions. I heard a report, and I'm not sure if it's true or not, so maybe you can tell me or not. I can't remember the actor's name. He played in the death episode. He was in Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. I can never think of his name off the top of my head when I talk about it. But supposedly Robert Redford, thank you. Supposedly he was in at a convention at one point, and I know it's pretty bad when I can't remember Robert Redford. And supposedly he was asked the question about that particular episode, and he gave the person who asked that question an extremely rude answer about how he thought it was a little minor little show that he wasn't interested in, and the only one to talk about is his movie. I was kind of wondering if you'd heard anything about that.
I have never heard Robert Redford be anything but extraordinarily gracious, not only about The Twilight Zone, but about Rod Serling, because you have to remember, Rod Serling was very important to Robert Redford's career, not just because of that Twilight Zone episode, which actually George Clayton Johnson wrote, but also because one of the breakthrough performances for him was the very last episode of Playhouse 90. Rod was a major contributor to Playhouse 90. Some of his best work, like Requiem for Heavyweight, was done for Playhouse 90. And the very last Playhouse 90 was a drama about a World War II era drama called In the Presence of Mine Enemies, and Robert Redford played a young German soldier in that. And that was a breakthrough role for him. So, as a matter of fact, Redford sent me, one of the things I did with my Twilight Zone book is I have guest lessons throughout the book.
Oh, cool.
I asked a bunch of the great Rod Serling fans, other horror and science fiction writers, and people who have been associated with the show to send me what they thought their best lesson was from the Twilight Zone. And Robert Redford sent me one for that, which very, very gracious. It's in, you know, so it's in the book. So I certainly have never heard that. I mean, maybe he was there to talk about a certain movie and didn't want to talk about the Twilight Zone at the time. But he has never been anything except extraordinarily appreciative of what Rod Serling meant to his career.
Yeah, because I was a little concerned about that story, considering how much Rod Serling helped the career of so many of those actors in the black and white days, like Telly Savalas.
And, that's right.
And I know he gave Burgess Meredith a good boost, a huge boost, with four episodes on his show. He must have really liked Burgess Meredith.
Well, what was not to like? Burgess Meredith gives four great performances in each one, of, you know, tied only by Jack Klugman as far as giving four great performances.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I gotta say my favorite by him was always going to be The Obsolete Man. I thought that was a fantastic performance by him.
It's in many ways my favorite episode. It's up there. I always say to people when they say, "What's your favorite Twilight Zone episode?" My standard response is that depends on what day you ask.
Oh,
But one of the ones that's always in for me in the discussion is The Obsolete Man. And I don't know that there are many episodes that have more resonance today than that one.
I would think it would be interesting to go around the room here and see. It's really hard to narrow down, and it might be on the day, as Tim said. But to see what everybody's favorite episode is, which is kind of usually the first one that comes to your mind when you think of Twilight Zone. I'll tell you, one of my very favorite, and there's so many great ones, I don't want to put them down, but probably one of my favorites is A Game of Pool, with Jack Klugman and Jonathan Winters.
Yeah, my favorite was of all time, just only second to The Obsolete Man would be Death Head Revisited.
Ah, good tale. How about ECW?
Yeah.
I'm going to say Disturbed Man, and because that's a double-edged sword sort of episode, a lot of his work was against the firming up of armaments and Cold Wars and not trusting anyone, but this one gives you a caveat of trust somebody, but just be ready to be betrayed. And that's what that comes off to me is. And I really enjoyed that episode.
Mark, before you go on to that, wasn't the person who originally wrote the short story that was based on, was he wasn't real happy with that way that episode went, was he?
Well, it was Damon Knight. And Damon Knight actually, was a more known as kind of an anthologizer. He wasn't that well known as an author, and he didn't really write that many great stories when you come right down to it. So this was it's sort of an outlier in a way, because it's a story that Rod adapted for the Twilight Zone, and of course there is a problem with it. There is a logical problem with To Serve Man, which is that the idea, first off, you could never have translated the book. You can never have translated they have all the code people trying to crack what the book is, and without some kind of Rosetta Stone, you cannot interpret a language that is that foreign. So that's number one. And the second thing is the idea that the word to serve, the term to serve, would have the same double meaning in another an alien language. That would be absurd. they're coming from light years away, and they have a language that has the same double meaning. It just happens to be on a cookbook. But for all of that, it's a great episode. And it's not
only
a great
thought,
episode.
Hey, Mark, I always thought that the title To Serve Man was actually more of a double entendre, as the fact of the candidates were honest all the way up through the episode on what they were planning on doing. They told the exact truth, which is what, in my opinion, was what the book was for. They didn't want to come out and say they were going to use man as a condiment into your soup, as Sterling said at the end. But they, to be honest, they had to give you an opportunity to find that out.
I'll tell you how much I love that episode. It's the first chapter that I wrote in the book. It's the chapter that was actually the sample chapter we sent around to publishers. It sold the book. And one of the reasons I used To Serve Man is it's a great parable, but it's open to interpretation as to what it is saying. There are many interpretations you can put on To Serve Man. You could look at it as basically a retelling of the Trojan horse story. That, you know, it is basically hiding in plain sight. But there's all, you know, you could literally, as the chapter title in my book says, you could literally take it for the old piece of advice of never judge a book by its cover. Because, you know, this becomes, but, you know, I mean, there are a lot of fun interpretations to it. Like, you know, you are what you eat, or you are what eats you. There's just so many great ways to look at that.
And you got to admit that Sterling's ending lines for that particular one were a lot of fun.
it's one of the most memorable moments in all of the Twilight Zone. And the image of the Canimate, played by Richard Kiel, who's also in two episodes of The Night Stalker, of course. You know, all of that is just makes that. And as I say, you know, when people sort of say, like, what's your favorite Twilight Zone episode? It really does. I mean, I will always put The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street very high on my list, because it too is one of the most resonant. And it may be the episode which is more resonant today than it was when it was written, because we are so divided by suspicion of each other.
Yeah.
And it is probably the biggest cautionary tale to come out of the Twilight Zone for today. Everybody in the country should be forced to sit down and watch that episode.
I kind of think everyone should have an opportunity to enjoy that show, and unfortunately there's a lot of younger people out there who refuse to watch it simply because it's in black and white, which is a shame.
Yeah. Well, but a lot of people still do watch it. I mean, the good thing is that there's always going to be people who are resistant to black and white, but there's always people who will give it a chance on certain things. And, you know, one of the great things that I love about horror fans is horror fans are much more in tune with the history of the genre than other genres. You know, it's like somebody could say, I'm into comedy and not know who the Marx Brothers are. That's entirely possible in this day and age. Yeah. Somebody can say, I'm into musicals and not know who Rodgers and Hammerstein are. But, you know, horror fans, they'll give it a shot, too. You know, you could say to a young horror fan, or somebody will say, like, have you ever seen The Invasion of the Body Snatchers in 1956? No, should I see it? Yeah, check it out. And they'll check it out, and they'll come back, wow, that was great. That was wonderful.
Yeah.
Is there anything else like that? Oh, yeah, there's plenty
more. Silent films, too.
Yeah, and you can take, that's right, you can take them right back to Phantom of the Opera, Nosferatu, or The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
There you go.
It's one of the things I like about that genre, is that they're more willing to give it a chance. And The Twilight Zone, because it's just great storytelling, you know, they're more willing to give it, and it's only a half hour. Give them one, and if they like the one, they're hooked. You got him.
Yeah.
How about it, Gar? What is your favorite Twilight Zone?
Well, I want to toss out that To Serve Man, I couldn't get it to float. The reason is these aliens come all the way here, and they don't know what basil is. But, I like the man in the bottle. I love that that is amazing. It's like these people that are out there, kind of like the lottery, you know, when they get it, they don't know what to do with it, and then a lot of them find themselves back in ruin. So that's a good one. And then the Howling Man is just, mind your business there, you know. I mean, just, come on in from the rain. No, don't go in that closet. I have to go in that closet. No, you don't. It's our closet. Stay out of our closet. I don't know. That was weird.
Yeah.
I guess, you know,
the man in the bottle is more of a be careful what you wish for situation.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
True.
Yes.
Well, that's a theme that comes up a lot in the Twilight Zone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For me, my most frequent answer, because I too have different ones on different days, but most often I will answer that it's the tale of Hyder and Old Rip. That's right. I'm talking about The Hunt for sentimental reasons.
Yeah,
that is just like
yeah.
such a heartwarming episode to me. I just love it.
You know, that's an
yeah,
interesting choice because Earl Hamner wrote it, the later who did The Waltons.
Yeah.
And there
right.
are two episodes where dogs are the heroes. There's The Hunt, and then there is Little Girl Lost, which Richard Matheson
yes.
wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And the dogs
yeah,
are the
yeah.
heroes of
yeah.
both episodes. And Rod Serling, he loved animals. Rod Serling was an animal lover, but he mostly loved dogs. He was a dog person, and he always had dogs. There's many great pictures of dogs. If Rod was over somebody's house and there was a dog, he'd get down and play like a litter mate with the dog. And so he just adored dogs. And it's odd that there's two episodes with dog heroes, and Rod didn't write either one of them. But you know he approved of them. You know that he's, you know.
Yeah.
You know he had to have loved both those episodes.
We talked in show prep about it took a remarkable life. To become the type of writer that he and director and producer that he was. Can you share with us a little bit about his early life leading up to his more well-known career?
Sure. You know, Rod grew up in Binghamton, New York, his hometown. And by the way, let me get in a plug before I say anything and I forget to say this. If anybody finds themselves in the vicinity of Binghamton, New York on August 12th, 13th, or 14th, come on by, because that's the annual Serling Fest in Binghamton, New York, which is a celebration of Rod Serling and the Twilight Zone. It's held every year in Rod's hometown, and this year the dates are the weekend of August 12th, 13th, and 14th. I'll be there. Mark Sucre is going to be there. Martin Grams, who wrote a great book on the Twilight Zone, is going to be there. Ann Serling, who wrote a great book about her dad. So it's a wonderful place to sort of come and share your love of Rod Serling. So anyway, Rod considered Binghamton his hometown. It's where he grew up, and he had an idyllic childhood. He had parents who adored him, an older brother who he was very close with, and he kind of had the childhood that he depicts in the episode Walking Distance with Gig
okay.
Young, the retired mm-hmm. businessman who walked back into his own childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
he had that kind of childhood. He very much idealized that childhood. And the day he graduated Binghamton High School, he volunteered for military service in World War II. And Rod talked himself into not just the military, but the paratroopers. They should have never taken. He was undersized. He was underweight. Too short. He was a very personable guy. And he talked himself into not just doing a very dangerous job, but he ended up doing it in a very dangerous place because he got stationed in the South Pacific, and he became part of the paratroopers who were dropped into the islands that the American forces were retaking, island by island, and the paratroopers would go
yeah.
in first. And so so he saw a lot of death. He saw a lot of friends die. He got injured. I mean, he came back from the war very much injured emotionally and physically. He was carrying shrapnel around in his knee, which he would carry around for the rest of his life. And friends would remember that knee would go out on him. He would sometimes tumble down the stairs at home, or if he would play, he would wrap it when he was playing tennis or badminton or something like that. And he would play so hard that after a while, blood would start to seep through the bandage. You know, he carried the wounds of that war. He comes back from World War II, and he doesn't really know what he wants to do. He's got this kind of vague idea that he's going to be a physical education teacher. But he goes to Antioch College in Ohio, in southeastern Ohio, in Yellow Springs. He goes there, and again, he's thinking about being a physical education teacher and working with kids. But it's here he discovers writing, and he discovers that he can work through the trauma of the war through writing, that it's cathartic. So this is why Ohio is holy ground for Rod Serling fans. He not only discovers
right.
his profession here, his calling here. But he becomes a writer here because between Antioch College and then going on and working at radio and television stations in Cincinnati, this is where he starts to develop the themes that he's going to carry through his entire life. Because Rod's themes don't change. He's always interested in the price of war, in how we treat the elderly, in bigotry,
how we treat
and
each
prejudice.
Other.
Yeah. Well, he once said that, you know, prejudice is the, you know, the greatest problem we face as a society. So Rod
yeah,
is
a great episode
working these things.
Oh, sorry. A great episode for that is he's alive.
Right. Oh, yeah.
With Hitler.
He addresses that in Death's Head Revisited, too,
mm-hmm.
The one that's set in the concentration camp. And but if it wasn't for World War II, and if it wasn't for the trauma of World War II, I really don't think Rod would have become a writer. I don't think he would have discovered writing. It wouldn't have been a reason to. It really was a form. So you have this kind of dividing point in his life. Everything before he graduates high school is very happy, nostalgic, and idyllic. And then he goes through really the trauma of the war. And those things sort of feed the nostalgia for the lost youth and the trauma of the war are two of the things which really are motivating factors for him to become a writer. And, you know,
his childhood
throughout
sounds,
the 50s.
Oh, I was just going to
go
talk about that. I was just going to interject that his childhood sounds a great deal akin to Ray Bradbury, who wrote Dandelion Wine, that was a reflection of his childhood, which was in the same fashion. Very happy, very idyllic, almost a finding of fantasy land right in your own backyard, if you will. So I'm of the opinion, I'm thinking the war was the catalyst, but I'm thinking somewhere down the line he probably would have written something, because that's far too much talent to just have been in hibernation for the rest of his life.
It reminds me of a joke by George Carlin about pigeons in New York. Pigeons get to New York and they're like, boo, 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 boo. About 2 weeks later, they're like,
okay.
Well,
Rod would have ended up writing something too, although I don't know if it would have been, you know, as epic as the Twilight Zone or the situations which he concocted for that TV series without his situations in the war. Like I guess there was a story, and Mark, you can back it up or not if I'm wrong, but I understand he actually saw his best friend die when a drop fell on his head.
It wasn't just a drop. It was the drop was from American forces. It was food, they would drop food from planes and crates, and this was survival for the troops. And they were on the beach, and one of the crates hit one of his closest friends while he was talking to him. So you know, he not only saw death, he saw it under very tragic circumstances. Also, another very tragic thing happened that was very is that towards the end of the war, Rod's father, who he was very close to, died. You know, like one of the things everybody immediately says about Rod, because Rod died at 50 in 1975. Rod died at 50 years old, and everybody immediately says, "Oh, the cigarettes." You know, well, look, the cigarettes did not help, and there's no question that he probably should have quit. A lot, you know, he was a chain smoker, and it's hard to even envision Rod without the cigarette in his hand. But
hero.
The fact of the matter is that Rod's father died at almost the exact same age of a heart attack. Rod probably inherited a bad ticker. You know, there's just no two ways about that. So did the cigarettes help? No. But Rod may have died young anyway, because his own father did. And so he had heredity was against him from that standpoint.
Was there not some sort of a mishap in his final days in the hospital?
Well, you know, open heart surgery was new then. You know, they were trying, but you know, I mean, he suffered a second massive heart attack on the table, so you know, he was it was probably going to be the end anyway. You know, there was an effort to try to save him, obviously. But, you know, this was still a very new thing, and, you know, it's hard to say, you know, all we know is what we know, and, you know, we know that he died at 50, which is tragically young, also considering how much more he probably would have written, you know, that he was still in his prime. He was still, you know, the sweet spot for writers is supposed to be 40 to 60. That is the age when you have as much life experience as you need, and you also still have the energy and the power and concentration to do great works. So Rod died at 50. He was in the middle of what could be considered his prime. And who knows what he would have... I think he would have written Broadway plays and novels. I personally think that. I think
a quick segue for a moment for David, who is also a Mark Twain aficionado. I was just curious that although Mark Twain had more fame than his contemporary Ambrose Bierce, did those two ever, as far as you know, ever cross paths with each other, or perhaps more interestingly, did they ever cross swords with each other? Because Ambrose Bierce, I think, was a bit more of a, well, when you use the word curmudgeon, I would put that in italics, embolden it, and underline it for Ambrose Bierce. I was just curious about that.
And Bierce's nickname was Bitter Bierce, and not without reason. Yes, Bierce and Twain knew each other in San Francisco as young writers. They were part of that San Francisco group that at the time included several young writers who were emerging as this kind of California group. So they did know each other, but they were not friends. They did not go on and travel in the same circles. The difference between Bierce and Twain, I think, is that Bierce, who is from Ohio, was in the Civil War. He volunteered and fought with the Indiana infantry, and he saw a lot of action, and he saw a lot of bad action. He was at Shiloh, and he poured that into those stories, those amazing short stories of his. So, you know, Bierce saw a lot in the war. Twain was shaped by the war too, but in a different way, is that he was a pilot on the Mississippi River when the war started, and he lost his profession because of the war. He joined a home guard unit in Missouri, deserted after 2 weeks, and headed west. He skedaddled out of there. So he did not, he was shaped by the war, but he wasn't affected by it the way Bierce was. But yes, they did, you know, it's a good question. But since you brought up Mark Twain, I will say this. One of the reasons I wrote the book, I do a talk on the parallels between Mark Twain and Rod Serling, of which there are many. But one of the things that gave me the idea for the book was a line that Mark Twain used late in his life, which was he had gotten a letter from a little French girl named Helene Picard, and she wrote him a letter where she basically said, you know, I know you're basically known as a funny man, but I got the idea behind all the joking that you're really trying to teach us something very serious. And Twain wrote back to this little girl and basically said, you're on it. You got it. But don't tell anybody. You don't tell anybody. I am. And then he said, I am a moralist in disguise. Is there a better description of Rod Serling than that? A moralist in disguise. That's what Rod was doing in the Twilight Zone. He was using... The way Twain used used humor, Serling used fantasy to get the moral across. And because he knew if you preach at people, they're not, you know, what is the Twilight Zone? They are parables. Where have we heard that word before for teaching? Where have we heard that word for instruction? And you say, oh, you mean the New Testament. Well, you can go all the way back to the Greek. You can go all the way back to Aesop and Aesop's fables and see how parables and storytelling were used to teach people a moral lesson. And that's what the Twilight Zone is. And Rod Serling is a moralist in disguise. So he has a lot of spiritual DNA shared with Mark Twain.
The other thing I think that reflects part of Rod's genius is his ability to broach topics that were a bit taboo in those days, and use science fiction to approach these topics.
Well, that's why he created the Twilight Zone. He created the Twilight Zone because when he started writing for television in the early 50s, television was sort of the Wild West at the time. There were no rules. They were inventing it as they went. But by the end of the 50s, television had gotten civilized. And now there was nothing but rules. And they kept saying to him, you can't say this because those stations will get upset. You can't say that because the sponsor will get upset. You can't write this.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, it was getting a lot harder to get the message across. And so in the late 50s, Rod came up with this idea, and he was rolling the dice. He was rolling the dice. He had a gamble. And the gamble was this, was that I can write about the exact same things I've been writing about for the last 10 years. But if I put it on a spaceship or I put it on an alien planet, the sensors won't even lift an eyebrow. And he was absolutely right. He put one over on everybody. You know, I mean, and who's sitting there learning from this but Gene Roddenberry?
I was going to say.
Well, and Roddenberry credited him with it because, you know, but the Twilight Zone goes off the air in 65. Star Trek starts in 66. And Roddenberry went to school on Rod Serling, and he said that at Rod Serling's memorial service. He said, you know, that this is who he learned it from, that if I put it on a spaceship and send it out to the stars, they're not going to realize I'm talking about war. I'm talking about prejudice. I'm talking about bigotry. I'm talking about all these themes. And that's exactly what he was doing. So, you know, we have Rod to thank for an awful lot.
Yeah, as especially the episode, if you're talking about prejudice and stuff, is was it I Am the Night, Color Me Black. That was a great episode to that one.
Yeah.
You know, and you could show that side by side with the Star Trek episode about the two aliens, was one's black on one side and one's white on the other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
right.
They hate each other. But the colors are on opposite sides. You know,
right.
And that's as obvious a metaphor for prejudice as you can possibly get. And, you know, and again, because it was in a science fiction show at the height, you know, of the 60s, NBC mm-hmm. didn't bat an eye about that.
Yeah, that reminds me of something Mel Brooks said once when he was asked about To Be or Not to Be, his movie. They asked him why he always uses comedy for his to make a point. Because he pointed out that if you try to teach an audience something when they're watching it, and you make it too obvious, they'll turn you off.
Yes.
But the moment they think they're being taught something, they'll turn you off. But if you can tell a story and make them think about it, they'll learn a lot more than they would if you think that they're preaching to them.
I think a great example is Dino De Laurentiis' King Kong. It was a real turnoff to me because it was so obvious of what they were trying to do with it, with the moral of the story, so to speak. I just dislike it for many reasons, but that's one of them.
Yeah, it's okay to tell a morality story as long as you have flatulence in there.
and I gathered that, go ahead, I've lost my thought.
He does that to people.
Would that be a brain fart?
I wanted to sidetrack again, if I may be so bold as to sidetrack again with David, because you wrote your book on Dashiell Hammett, and one of my favorite writers, I believe they were a couple from time to time, Lillian Hellman.
That's right.
And
yeah,
is
they were
there,
off and on a couple.
Is that a cat in the background, or is this blog talk?
Anyway. That's my cat.
The cat was talking is about his favorite book.
Meow, 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 meow.
There you go.
Somebody said cat.
It's all my fault. But Lillian Hellman, I was just wondering, since we're gushing over all the guys here, especially Rod Serling and everything, for Lillian Hellman, I was just wondering if any of her work, and if you're not familiar with Lillian Hellman, She did the work of these three, which was done in black and white.
Yeah.
The Children's Hour, which has been done. Miriam Hopkins did a version. Shirley MacLaine did a version. I think there was another even more modern version. Shirley MacLaine with Audrey Hepburn, which is excellent. And also, if you ever watch the movie with Jane Fonda called Julia, which she kind of sort of said she based it kind of sort of maybe almost sort of on a real person, but not necessarily. She never got that dance right. But what I was just saying is, do you think any of her work influenced Dashiell or vice versa, perchance? Because they were really close in a time in their lives.
Well, he stopped writing as she began. I mean, when they met, he was almost through as a writer. He'd almost done with everything he was going to write. And he he dedicated himself to her. He became her editor. And that relationship, you know, Julia as a movie, there's a lot in Julia which has been debated and disputed because it's thought she stole Muriel Gardner's story as a resistance fighter. But one of the things that movie gets right is the relationship between Dashiell Hammett, played by Jason Robards, and Lillian Hellman, because he became her editor, her mentor, her guide, and, you know, he basically, his creative outlet was basically unselfishly giving himself to her as a guide into literature, because he pretty much stopped writing. The only book she saw him write was The Thin Man. The only book that she's got to see him do was the very last one of the five major novels. So, you know, it's an interesting relationship. There's a couple of really great books about them, and, you know, it's an endlessly fascinating. They're both endlessly fascinating.
To get
Thank
back
you.
To,
just
to,
curious oh. about that.
To get back to Sterling, just for a moment, I'm sorry, because I know the book you're on is Everything I Need to Know About the Twilight Zone, which is cool. I want you to look into it, actually. It's interesting how no one's been able to replace Rod Sterling with a Twilight Zone. They've tried to reboot that series so many times, and every time I still think what grabs you is Rod Sterling's opening and closings at the beginning and end of the stories. The stories are great, too, but... And every time you try to replace him with somebody else, it never works.
I think every time you try to redo the Twilight Zone in any way, it kind of doesn't work. Some things always work and some things don't. But you're trying to recapture something which was of the moment. I mean, you have to, and not just Rod Serling, you'd have to go back and recapture what Richard Matheson and Charles Beaumont, George Clayton Johnson, and Earl Hamner were all doing. That was an amazing, you know, group. And, you know, the problem is every time somebody tries to revive the Twilight Zone, they call it the Twilight Zone. You know, and if somebody came to me and said, you know, we're going to give you a chance to do an anthology, a fantasy anthology series, I'd say, oh, that's great, but we want you to call the Twilight Zone. I'd run in the other direction because you're competing with a ghost. How in the world can you ever compare to what was originally done? I think people have done great anthology series, fantasy, since the Twilight Zone, and almost all of them are ones that where people pursued their own vision, and then when pursued their own ideas, and shaped their own sensibility. You can't sort of recapture the sensibility of the Twilight Zone because that's gone. That's no longer done. So you look at the 1980s Twilight Zone, and there were some excellent episodes in there. And
there
Jordan
were.
Peele
there were.
Did some nice work. But, you know, the thing is, I would have preferred to have seen an anthology series from Jordan Peele that he created from the ground up, and he called it his own thing.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to see something called The Twilight Zone from Jordan Peele. I want to see something from Jordan Peele that comes from Jordan Peele. And I think that's one of the problems with the efforts to redo the Twilight Zone. In the back of our minds, we all have memories, and we're always comparing what it was. You know,
I think that's why for me the Twilight Zone movie was acceptable because it wasn't pretentious. Rather, here's some retellings with some modern actors and modern cameras.
I think, you know,
except
one of the
except for the Vic Morrow episode. Yeah.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, just to put a, just to say it, because it's just a short point for me because of, I mean, no, for the director and the crew and the producers who really didn't get what they deserved, because they should have been really hit hard for that nonsense. It wasn't just, Vic Morrow was a seasoned veteran actor. He could do whatever he wanted, but there were children on that set. They were not well cared for, and that's always a harsh point with me, which I will not ever watch that movie again. I'm sorry to be a devil's advocate, if you will, but that was just something that in my book is unforgivable. But I also wanted to say, in regards, you're quite right, an anthology series, for example, Chris Carter, who is a huge fan of Night Stalker, he did the same sort of flavor, just in a different mix, when he created Mulder and Scully and the FBI and the X-Files. Mm-hmm. And that is what I would love to see. I would love to see a Kolchak, but not a Carl Kolchak, because I'm sorry if there's anybody out there who liked that Night Stalker Kolchak that came out, the 90s or something?
Mm-hmm. Oh, God, no, that was terrible.
It was a colossal waste of time. I mean, I love some of the performers. Gabrielle Union, who is a marvelous, marvelous actress. She's a wonderful performer, but she was wasted in that. It was a waste of space. I do not know how they got the green light to do that. It was so morose. It had no comedy. It had no verve. The actors were, I don't know, they were just poorly cast from the get-go. It was just I'm sorry.
Well, there are very distinct reasons for that. And
a lot of these repeats.
I'm going to tell them.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that there were. It had a lot to do with ABC. It had a lot to do with the network. And when I redo the Kolchak book, I'm going to tell the story about why that 2005 Night Stalker went so wrong. And the reasons are not as obvious as you think they are. But there's a backstory to that, and it did go very wrong. But you know, something you said, that you'd rather see somebody do something with Kolchak, which was more in the spirit of Kolchak, but not that. I think there have been great anthology series which have been in the spirit of the Twilight Zone, but have been called the Twilight Zone. And one that comes to mind immediately is Black Mirror. And I think Black Mirror was a brilliant series. In some ways, it owed more to The Outer Limits than it did to The Twilight Zone. But Charlie Brooker, who did that series, he did it his own vision. His vision was not The Twilight Zone. It was Black Mirror. And he told anybody who would listen to him that his primary influence and his hero was Rod Serling, and he was doing Black Mirror because he wanted to do his own anthology series, which was inspired by The Twilight Zone, but was not an attempt to redo The Twilight Zone. That's the way to do it, right there. Black Mirror is the way to do it. And if somebody was to try to do something in the Kolchak realm, it should be something in the exact, be inspired by it the way Chris Carter was inspired by it and came up with the X-Files.
To jump in on something, we were talking a minute ago about Rod Serling in the military. I'm a disabled veteran myself. In high school and college, taking literature classes, there's an aspect to understanding literary device and definition of what is irony. And if someone had taken me aside and trying to get me to understand it and say, see that soldier? He's going to get splattered with life-saving food in a crate. That is irony.
That's a bit of dark humor there.
I have an interesting question here. One thing, just something I've noticed between the Outer Limits fans and the Twilight Zone fans. The Twilight Zone fans truly respect and really like the original Outer Limits. But people who are Outer Limits fans first don't think as much about the Twilight Zone. Have you noticed that?
I have, and I think, you know, one reason is because the Twilight Zone has outstripped the fame of genre. It escaped genre.
the Twilight Zone, you know, Stephen King once said, the Twilight Zone is about as near immortal as anything could ever be. And I think that's probably, you know, true. And I think to some people, the Outer Limits was a true and genuine science fiction show. And it was. The Twilight Zone wasn't really science fiction. And that's where the distinction comes in. So a fan of The Outer Limits is going to look at The Twilight Zone and say, well, you know, it's not really science fiction. Well, it's not, but it wasn't sort of supposed to be. And it is kind of hard to define. What is The Twilight Zone? Is it horror? Sometimes. Is it science fiction? Sometimes. Is it fantasy? Yeah. Is it mystery? Yeah. It's kind of all of the above, none of the above. It's what Rod Serling said it was. It was as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It encompasses all those things. It's the Twilight Zone. That's the best definition you can come up with it. And I'm a big fan of all those anthologies. You know, the one you didn't mention was Thriller, the horror series with Boris Karloff.
Yes.
Thriller was fantastic, you know.
It was.
And that's the one the horror fans go to. You know, the science fiction fans say, The Outer Limits. The horror fans say, Thriller. But the Twilight Zone gets both and more. And I think, you know, there's a certain amount of, you know, resentment to that.
One step beyond. Some of the episodes, not all, but some of the episodes were sort of based on, as our host John Newland would say, of events that were supposed to have occurred. And there are lots of excellent, excellent, wonderful young actors who were on there as well. Purnell Roberts was in there. Christopher Lee was in there. I think Shatner's done just about everything he can on the planet and now on outer space. But you had Lloyd Blockner and all these other tons of wonderful talent. And it was just some of those episodes where I would compare them to some Outer Limits and Twilight Zones. I was just wondering your take on that.
One Step Beyond is actually on the air before The Twilight Zone. It gets on the season before, so it's actually the one that's out there a little bit before. And I think the difference is with One Step Beyond is One Step Beyond did not have sort of the morality backbone that The Twilight Zone did. It was very good storytelling. It was excellent storytelling. I'm a big, like I said, I'm a big fan of all those anthologies. I think they all do one.
Houndale.
Sorry. I couldn't help myself.
I thought I was having an incident there. I heard the angel sing.
Yeah.
But
is that a crate of food?
Hey, Dale, before we let things get away completely. Hang on a second, Tim. Before he gets away completely, we need to start up a gem of Rod Serling's from 1953. We need to at least get part one in here. Give us a chance to sit back and collect ourselves and get ready to barrage Mark with our next set of questions.
That sounds great. Now, Dave, this one's called It Happens to You. And where did we first hear this?
I first heard this from NPR, a station down in Cincinnati, really got a lot of national attention for this. And it was rediscovered I'm trying to think when that was. It was 2003 around there. They found it in one of the Cincinnati, I think WLW's studio, and cleaned it up, and they put it out there, shared it with all to hear. And unless you were hearing NPR at that time, you probably didn't know a whole lot about that. But that's what we have to share here tonight, along with our amazing guest, Mark Dowidziak.
We'll be back after part one of It Happens to You.
The time, October 1953. The place, New York City, USA. Your name is Dan Shevlin. This is your story. It happens to you. This is what we choose to call the human comedy. It takes place in a round theater called the Globe. Continents and oceans are the sets. You, in the millions who share your existence, are the cast. The lives you live are the plays, and tonight you're a detective named Shevlin. Your Achilles heel is a memory. With you, it's a memory of a childhood game that became a reality, a game called You Be the Bad Guy. This is New York City. Manhattan Island, purchased from the Indians in the 1600s, molded, girded, riveted into a giant steel and concrete city with 8 million people. You're one of them, Detective Dan Shevlin. And standing there in front of the mirror shaving, you listen to the sounds of the city outside, waking up, stretching, coming to life, to a discordant early morning symphony of garbage cans, milk bottles, traffic, and the familiar voices of the kids in the hall playing cops and robbers. The bang your dead age, when death takes turns and tragedy is play-acting. That glorious time of being a kid, what you used to be an eon ago, when your badge came out of a cereal box and your gun was a pointed finger. An eon ago, Dan Shevlin, remember?
Hey, Jamie, you up? Coffee's done.
Yeah, I'm up.
The kids?
You'll be the bad guy. No, you'll be the good guy. No, I'll be the good guy. Oh, what a beautiful morning. It ain't.
Come on, up and at 'em. Get your coffee. Say, you know, it wasn't so long ago that we were playing cops and robbers, too.
You know something? Looks like you're still playing it. Ah, the shoulder holster detective.
Tools of my trade, kid brother.
You can have it.
A little peaked this AM? A little mad on, maybe? What's the matter? Tough night last night?
The usual. Ever work in a hardware store?
There's worse jobs, Jamie.
Sure. Dog catcher. Cleaning out hen houses. Wearing a tin badge for 30 years so you can retire $30 a month.
Well, that tin badge hasn't done too bad filling your till the past few years. I suggested you get on the force.
Me? On the force? You got rocks, Daniel. I'm low on luck, but I'm not that low.
You're 24 years old, Jamie. One of these days, you're going to have to stop singing the blues and find yourself. 6 jobs in 6 months. What are you trying to do, set a record?
What's this?
What's what?
This dough on the dresser. You got paid off last night, didn't you? Make that 7 jobs in 6 months.
Now, what happened this time? Get your thumb caught in the cash register?
The owner was always jawing at me. I decided I'd switch jobs. This one didn't appeal to me.
You better switch stories. That one doesn't appeal to me. Now, what do you do?
Look around. I got time. Hand me no cigarettes, will you? Thanks. I might try writing a book. The Mentality of a Cop. Personal observations of my big brother, Dan.
That'd make dull stuff.
Don't kid yourself. Cops are complex characters. Look at yourself. Remember the cops and robbers we used to play? You always made me be the bad guy. And instead of shooting me, you'd talk me into changing. You got a deal, you know, Dad. You're the only kid who never had to quit playing his favorite game. Old Peter Pan Shevlin in his Never Never Land of Badges and Beats. Where's that coffee?
Here. You got a nasty mouth at times, you know.
What is that, a misdemeanor, officer?
You bum.
Hey, let go of my hand. Come on now.
Hey, I gotta go. It's getting late. See you tonight, huh?
Sure, Lieutenant. Don't take any wooden crooks. I love the way you straighten that badge. Hey, leave me your extra one. I'll polish it up for you.
Oh, you're too kind. Hey, we'll eat out tonight. Have a little talk about your plans. See you later.
Sure, big brother. Lecture me some more.
Morning, Pete.
Morning, Dan.
Hey, Hadle, can you remember me?
No, don't tell me. It's Mr. Schultz. What are you doing these days?
Getting booked on pickpocket charges. All right, back to work, Mr. Schultz. I want to get this done. Your last place of regular employment.
No, I'm sorry about $10.
Schultz, your last place of employment.
Lieutenant Shevlin, you're looking at the greatest miscarriage of justice in Sacramento City. I'm a babe, Lieutenant. Like a lamb, I'm innocent.
Somebody get me a promo.
Lieutenant, talk about circumstantial evidence. I am minding my own business. I'm standing in line, waiting to get into a lecture. This person runs me in. Now, I ask you, where is the justice in this?
That's the whole story?
All but one minor detail. He had his hand in some guy's hip pocket, transferring his wallet.
Oh, I am nearsighted. I thought I was reaching in my own pocket. Honest, this is justice. A citizen stands in line waiting to get into a lecture, and he gets nabbed.
What was the name of the lecture?
Get ready to flip. The little man was going to hear all about Keats.
Oh, don't laugh, you ignoramus. You don't even know what a Keats is. Don't ask me no more questions. I know my rights. I want a lawyer.
You know, you don't need a lawyer, Schultz. With your talents, what you need is an agent.
Dan, when you're free. Shut it.
Who's your friend? Schultz? I used to pick him up regularly when I had a beat.
I thought he was your father. Such affection, Shevlin. Or maybe it's just nostalgia for the good old days when you wore brass buttons and took home half a salary. You get my point?
I take it something's not sitting well on you.
That's a conservative observation. Considering if I had a celluloid collar on now, it'd be up in smoke. Shevlin, you worry me. Usually when I get a good cop and promote him to plain clothes, I have to sit on him so he doesn't use his hands on prisoners. You? I get the other extreme. I get sweetness and light and psychology. I get a social work routine. Consider their home life. Take in account their new environment. There's no such thing as a bad boy. Shevlin, you enforce the law. You make the arrests. You forget the causes and stick to the effects. If a guy's off his rocker, a good alienist will figure it out. Those things are not your concern. You got a nice 14-hour-a-day job picking up hoods and tracing clues. You want a campaign for brotherly love? Make it a hobby and keep it away from here.
Okay, so I'm on the block, Cap, but I don't know why.
I'll tell you. A week and a half ago, you picked up a kid named Reardon.
Yeah, I stole some clothes.
That's the boy. Did you bring him in? Write it up, get a conviction? No, you didn't. That was too easy. Two hands, no psychiatry. The good lieutenant wants to play nurse. So you persuade the storekeeper not to prefer charges. It's the kid's second offense, and all he gets is a lecture.
He was 15 years old. His old man lived out of a box.
I don't care if his old man was the U.S. Senator from North Dakota and tried to bring back prohibition. The kid was caught cold with $100 worth of stolen property.
All right. I may have been a little too lenient.
Not little and not lenient. That was the stupidest, empty-headed bit I've ever seen. I just took a chewing from the D.A. Captain Vansky, he says. What's wrong with your department, he says. You know why he said that? Because your little altar boy figured a police force is a big Sunday school full of flabby-headed jerks who wouldn't use a set of knucks on Hitler. So he tried his luck a little further. You know what it was this time? Homicide, Shevlin. First-degree murder.
Murder?
Spelled with a big bloody M. You did the kid a big favor. You kept him out of stir for an old clothes wrap so he could get 99 years for the big one. And I'm on the phone 1 hour and 35 minutes trying to explain to the DA why one of my detectives is a lotus eater and let the kid get away so he could kill. Sorry, Dan. I'm going to have to change the color of your badge. Wipe off the lieutenant. It's plain detective now.
Demotion, huh?
What did you expect, a medal? The DA was all for putting you back in uniform. I stuck my neck out this far because usually you're a good cop. That's all. And tell Pete to slip it to that old man. What's his name? Schultz. I want a big conviction on the basis of previous arrests. And I want this department to get up on its haunches and roar for a change. And one other thing. Get a line on Frank Wiley.
You making book again?
We got a tip his face is dirtier than that. Get a line on him. See what else he's mixed up in.
Right.
And Dan.
Yeah?
Don't bother putting this guy on a couch for a psychoanalysis. If he gives you trouble, get tough.
What would you suggest, a whip?
Danny boy, I'd get rid of the chip if I were you. When I say tough, I don't mean brutal. I don't go in for the rubber hose treatment, you know that. But wise up, find a happy medium. And if it means handcuffs, use them.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, all of you guys, I'm telling you, I'm cueing you. None of you will have a job because I got friends in high places. Very high places.
Grandpa, the highest place you ever was the top rung of a barstool.
Yeah? Well, Chevron. Here, you guys. Here is the only decent guy in the whole department.
Shut up, Blazes.
Man, you could break a man's back that way. Easy.
Lieutenant... This ain't like you.
It isn't, Lieutenant Pop. Check your program. This is the last act. Pete, Captain Bansky would like you to slip it to the old gentleman here. That's SOP from here on in. Jonesy, Shevlin, get the file out on Frank Wiley. W-Y-L-I-E. Yeah. Shoot it up to me. Right. Mr. Schultz, you want to register a complaint?
Why, no.
Then eyes front, if you don't mind.
You're all taken care of, Grandpa. Let's go. Court convenes at 10. Just remember, this is going to hurt you more than it is me. Let's go.
We'll return to What Happens to You in just a little bit. Quite a story building
very,
up here.
A lot of Rod Serling type scripting in here for, you know, again, this is October 2nd of 1953, so early Rod Serling, but definitely you can see his flavor in there.
Mark, were you familiar,
are you
with,
familiar
this,
with
this episode or any of his early radio writing?
Oh, yeah, yeah, and I think you've got it exactly right, that it definitely embryonic Rod Serling. It's definitely, you know... This is very early work, but all of the flashes are there, all of the hallmarks, the terse dialogue, the big stakes that are in moral decisions by the individual, by the, you know, what you do and how you approach things. This is very, I mean, you know, that's his breakthrough drama was Patterns, which he did for Kraft, and that's what really broke him through as a nationally known writer. And that's what Patterns is. It's about, you know, an individual's making a choice and how you deal with a moral person in an immoral world or an immoral system. And, you know, so you do see Rod trying all these things out in those early stuff that he did in Cincinnati. And you could see the powerful writer he's going to turn into.
Let me ask you this. This is a little off of Twilight Zone. Rod Serling was given the ability or the rights to be able to produce Night Gallery, but he didn't, and he turned it down. Do you think it would have been a tremendously different series had he taken it on?
Oh, unquestionably. Unquestionably, Night Gallery would have been Rod wanted to do Night Gallery to be sort of the horror equivalent of what he had done with Twilight Zone. And but he had worked – you have to remember, on Twilight Zone, Rod worked extraordinarily hard. He was a type A personality. But you start with the fact that he wrote more than 90 of the 156 scripts you know, that's a tremendous output over five seasons. That's a tremendous amount of writing.
Yeah.
Then he's also the showrunner. He's the, you know, the executive producer. He's the narrator. He's the on-screen host. He was working nonstop. I mean, he was working at such a pace, a killer pace. You know, one of the people, the name Ray Bradbury came up earlier, and one of the people I solicited a guest lesson for the book for was from Ray. And, you know, I knew Ray pretty well in the late 80s and early 90s. We were going to do a book together on Ray's work. And I still have cassettes and cassettes full of interviews with Ray. And one of the things we talked about was when he did the Ray Bradbury Theater, his own anthology series, the great lesson he took away from that was not to work so hard that it wasn't fun. And he did it basically because of what he saw Rod Serling go through. He said Rod Serling killing himself on the Twilight Zone. So Ray basically said, you know, I'm only going to do like 12 episodes a year. And the network came to him and said, but we want 16. And Ray said, no, you don't. And they said, yeah, we do. And they said, if we don't get 16, there won't be any show. There won't be any show if we don't do 16. And Ray said, well, it's really been nice knowing you. And they called him back the next day and said, we want to do 12. And he said, there you go. Because if I'm doing 16 episodes, I'm working. If I'm doing 12, I'm playing. And you want me to play for you. You don't want me to work for you. He got that lesson from watching Rod. So when Night Gallery came along, Rod didn't want to work that hard again. So he said, you know, I'll do it as long as I don't have to take on the duties of being the executive producer. And the executive producer was a guy by the name of Jack Laird. Now, Rod never thought that they would not take his advice and follow his suggestions. And what happened was Night Gallery became as much Jack Laird show as it was Rod Serling. Rod was still the principal writer, and he still contributed a lot of scripts and some, and he contributed some great episodes, like they're tearing down Tim Riley's bar. But
absolutely,
you know, it turned into a exercise in frustration because Jack Laird had very different ideas than Rod Serling. And Jack Laird, he loved those little stupid comic blackout bits that they used to do on Night Gallery, and which Rod just thought cheapened the show. And so it became a very, very different show, and then also a very frustrating experience for Rod. I love Night Gallery. Like I said, it's another anthology series, which I adore. I have all three seasons. I just did a commentary for Cool Air for the Kino Lorber Blu-ray release. So I'm a big Night Gallery fan, and I think Night Gallery at its best is really exceptional. But it was not Rod's show, and it, you know, it was not the show that it could have been.
Hey, this is Larry. You're going to start his show shortly on Twitch if you want to catch his show. But we're going to stick around here for a while with Mark Dowidziak, and shortly the conclusion of It Happens to You.
You folks have a good time.
I think it's
see you later. Boy.
Thanks,
bye,
Gar.
See you, Gar. See ya.
Bye.
I think it's interesting that the Night Gallery, it really was what Rod almost took to ABC after the Twilight Zone went off. He wanted to have the Rod Serling's Wax Museum.
That's right. That's right. He had quite a concept. It's a shame that – I think in a way it's a shame that didn't go, because I really think he had a good idea there. And I really think that would have been the show that he wanted to do. He even had an idea of how it was going to open, what the setting was mm-hmm. going to be. It was a really good idea. It was a, you know, and I understand that, you know, a lot of people would have immediately said it's not the Twilight Zone or it's different from the Twilight Zone. But I think at that point, Rod would have been in charge of it, and it would have been a very, you know, I think it would have been an exciting show in a lot of ways. You know, everything Rod
Mark,
did is interesting. Yes, go ahead.
I was just wondering, since I know he was so frustrated and burned out by the Twilight Zone that he essentially, sadly, sold the right to Twilight Zone to CBS, which is just a $1 billion cash cow for them. But was the same, did he sell the rights to anything else? Does Night Gallery belong to anyone? Is that held in a dead hand? Is that in domain, the public domain? And
no,
in any of his other ideas or anything, et cetera.
Well,
I was just wondering if his family still has rights to anything.
They do. They have rights to the stories. Rod retained the rights to his stories, to the words. So Rod did control that. What CBS owns is they own the name Twilight Zone. They own the concept. And they own the pictures. They own the prints. But the stories, Rod did retain the copyright on his own story. So the family still controls those stories. And so that was very bright of him. Universal controls Night Gallery. They own Night Gallery. But once again, Rod controls the copyright on his own stories. So that was one thing that he was very shrewd about. You know, everybody say, well, it was such a blunder to have sold the Twilight Zone back to CBS like that, and it was. He should have retained control of it. It would have been worth so much more than the payoff he got. But it wasn't as blind a deal as a lot of people sometimes think, because, again, he did retain control of the story and the rights to his stories. So CBS does not have sort of carte blanche on everything connected to the Twilight Zone.
Wow, that's a relief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, I wanted to circle back to, you mentioned Mel Brooks before, and you mentioned Mel Brooks saying about how, you know, you can't do comedy by professedly preaching at people and shaking your finger at them and things like that, that you have to keep them laughing and then not realize they're getting the moral. And the person who taught Mel Brooks that was Mark Twain, the same person who taught Rod Serling, that Mark Twain once said that humor must not professedly preach and it must not professedly teach, but it must do both, going to be eternal and if it's going to live. And Mel Brooks got that from Mark Twain, and Rod Serling got that from Mark Twain. And I think what's interesting is something I did not know until I did the Twilight Zone book, is that Mel Brooks is one of the biggest Twilight Zone fans on the planet. He loves.
I didn't know that.
So when I asked him for a guest lesson, he couldn't. He gave me one immediately, like right off the top of his head. He didn't even have to think about it. I said to him, you know, what's the greatest lesson you ever got from the Twilight Zone? And without thinking, he said to me, the greatest lesson I learned is that you need to reserve judgment and seriously buy into the creation and design of the filmmaker. You've got to give it all up and go along with the magic. Every time I watched The Twilight Zone, I was completely ready to surrender to it. That's what the mystery of creation is all about. Give yourself over to that wonderful, wonderful mystery.
See, and I always thought the mystery of creation had something to do with the back of a 74 Chevy, you know?
Sometimes it does.
Hey, Dale.
Yes, sir.
We need to finish off the story, but then when we come back, Mark's got some other projects he's working on. I think we need to spend some time seeing what he's working on and what he's finishing and finished up and where he's going next. Uh-oh, that's not the question you always get, Mark. What's your next?
Absolutely. Well, in this case, I'll be right about what the next book is because it's done.
Okay.
Frankly, I'm ashamed. I'm usually the clock watch, but yes, let's continue. It Happens to You, written and directed by Rod Serling.
Hello, kid.
Hello. What's the matter? Somebody get away?
Yeah. A lieutenancy. Took off like a big bird, streamlined.
You look it.
Yeah. 12 years in the force. Year and a half lieutenant. Suddenly I'm not tough enough for him.
What happened?
I let a kid off a week or so ago. He crosses me and commits murder. That's supposed to show something.
It shows you're a lousy judge of character. That's what it shows. You know something, big brother?
What?
I'm not surprised.
Meaning what?
Meaning you've always been too mushy to be a good cop. You got where you are because you're smart. And you plugged. But sooner or later, they were going to find you out. They had to. It's like when you and I were kids and played cops and robbers. You never went bang, bang. You tried to lecture. Made a dumb game. I never liked it.
I'm so sorry.
Look, I got a couple of calls I have to make. Open some cans, will you? I haven't time to eat out. I'll be back in about an hour or so.
Can't, Dan. I've got an appointment myself. Better grab a bite while you're out.
What's this appointment? Blonde or brunette?
This happens to be legitimate. About a job.
It's been a full day, then. I'll see you later, Jimmy.
Information? The residence of Frank Wiley. That's right. Frank Wiley. Wait a minute. I want to write that down here. What was it? Fletcher 74578. Yeah, I got it. Thanks.
Dan Shevlin, your brother Jamie is walking down the center aisle of a local arena where two stalwart young gentlemen with flat noses and truck gardeniers are demonstrating the manly art. Jamie's eyes, however, are not on the brilliantly lit ring. They're resting on a squat, pig-eyed man sitting in a second row seat.
Hi. You Frank Wiley?
That depends. Who wants to know?
I'm Shevlin. I phoned you about a job.
Yeah? Sit down. Plenty of room at prize fights nowadays. Television, you know.
Kid in black. Fast boy. Telegraphs his punch. See him drop his left?
Well, expert, huh? So, you want to work for me? You any relation to Dan Shevlin?
Brother.
Brother? Aren't you begging trouble? I don't sell frozen custards, you know. I'm in the hijacking business.
Deal me in.
Nobody said you were playing yet.
Come on, get up on your feet, you big palooka.
This guy is the only fighter who has to be carried both in and out of the ring. You see, kid, I gotta be choosy about my employees. How do I know you ain't gun-shy? That'd be like a soda jerk allergic to whipped cream. Get it? Gun-shy, allergic to... First lesson, kid. I said something funny. You laugh. That's part of the arrangement.
I don't get it.
Then maybe you'll get this.
Handy, huh? You haul off the slap, I catch your hand, and now you got a knife in your throat. I think fast, Mr. Wiley. I'm always prepared.
Turn around, kid.
Oh, I get it. You spot a bodyguard behind you.
Check. And that thing poking through the slats in your chair is a gun. I'm always prepared, too. But you aren't bad. Where'd you learn to use that shiv? You handle it nice.
My brother. He's a big theory man. He knows how to do anything. With a knife, wire, set of nuts. But it's all theory.
He don't put it to use, huh?
He's got a soul, Mr. Wiley. Very sensitive. And when he got it, he used up the family quota.
You're different, huh? What are you, kid? The cold-blooded killer type?
Try me.
I think I will. I'm short-handed. There's just one other thing. Where you been?
It took a while. Truck driving. Hardware store, that sort of thing. Then I got wise. I don't want to jingle coins. I want to count bills.
I think you'll do okay. When can you start?
I just punched in.
Good. Take off the knife and make yourself at home, kid. Now, get what I'm saying. This is the set.
Yeah?
Dan? Bansky, where you been?
just finished dinner. Try to get me?
3 times the fast half hour. We got a tip. Nice job. The party thinks the old Metropolitan Warehouse. You talked to Wiley?
Not yet.
Good bet he figures in this. Phone him up. We can cut out his first at home alibi anyway. Because I don't think he'll be there. Here's his phone number. Fletcher 74578.
Fletcher 745.
Well, what's the matter? Didn't you get it?
Well, I must have written it down before. It's on a paper here by the phone. Fletcher 74578.
All right, I'm sending 2 cars down there. One in front down the block, the other in the alley. Watch for them. And Danny, deal this one close to the undershirt. I don't want these fish getting away.
Check. See you later. That's funny. I must have written it down, but... Well, I'm sure I didn't. Nobody else could have... Well, why would Jamie call that number? Why, I wonder? Why?
All right, pipe down, you guys. You all get booked. We don't play no favorites.
Ah, nice work.
Thank you, Captain. Whoever stooled sure had it on target. It was the Metropolitan Warehouse. We caught him on the way out.
No trouble?
Well, there was a fourth guy. He shot the watchman, and then he hightailed it out of there. Lieutenant Shevlin went after him.
Okay, bet him down. We'll write him up in the morning.
How about a mouthpiece, Vansky? We still got it coming.
If I gave you birds what you had coming, you'd be hanging by broken thumbs from a red-hot pipe. Now, go ahead. Let him phone up. If Shevlin gets back, I want to see him.
Welcome home, Dan. Where you been? What's the matter?
I don't know. What's the matter?
You look like the last rose, kid. Like somebody died.
Somebody did die. A night watchman with a bullet in his head.
That's too bad. But that's your business.
Well, all of a sudden, it becomes personal business. All of a sudden, it hits close to home. It's in the family.
You knew this guy, this watchman?
No. No, but I'm closely related to the person who killed him.
Let go, Dan!
What's this you had in your belt, Jamie? A gun? Yeah, 2 bullets gone, the barrel hot.
I thought it was you behind me. You're a hard guy to shake.
Why, Jamie? Why? You dumb, stupid, crazy kid. If you needed dough, all you had to do was whistle. If you were in a jam, I was there all the time. Oh. All of a sudden, the bottom falls out. I got a living, walking nightmare. I don't get it, kid. Not you. Not Jamie. I don't get it. Why, Jamie? Why? One day you're a light-headed kid who thinks about dates. Next thing I know, you're a killer, a hood. One of the dirty, cold-blooded rats I've spent half of my life putting in jails.
Dan.
Shut up. Shut up. Jamie, what do you got?
That wasn't smart, Dan. Putting a gun on a bed where I could reach it.
Put it down, Jamie.
Can't, Dan.
Jamie, give me that gun. Get back in here.
Can't, Dan.
Okay.
That's more like it. I got a gun. Now you got a gun. Even Steven. Now we can play cops and robbers, Danny. Like old times, huh? I'll be the bad guy. You'll be the cop.
Jamie, come back up off those stairs.
Uh-uh. Can't, Dan.
Listen to me, Jamie. Listen, I'm soft. I hate to hurt people. It's what's held me down. I see too much good in everybody. But listen, Jamie. I got a job. And right now, you're not my brother. You're just anybody with a gun. You're just another menace.
Come on down, Danny. Cops and robbers. You start.
Jamie, put down that gun.
No. You put yours down.
Jamie, kid.
Come on, Dan. Play the game. Don't chicken on me. Don't make me ashamed, will you?
Jamie, I can't.
Come on, Dan. If you don't, I will.
Make way. Pipe down, everybody.
Oh, hi, Lieutenant. This one from the warehouse?
Yeah. Put a blanket around him.
A blanket?
That's what I said, a blanket. I want him comfortable.
Lieutenant, he's comfortable. He's never going to be uncomfortable again.
Type a report, will you, Pete?
Sure, Dan.
Are you ready?
Yeah, Dan.
Name is... was James Shevlin. Age 24. Height 5'11". Occupation. What was it? Just say clerk. Shot while attempting escape. Victim was suspect in armed robbery. It resulted in homicide.
All right. But I don't see why all the time gotta be the bad guy.
Victim pronounced dead on arrival. Gunshot wound.
Oh,
abdomen.
Man.
Sign it. Shevlin, detective. Third precinct. Oh, Jamie. Oh, God. Jamie.
So you sit there, Detective Shevlin, pounding a fist against the desk. Brutal, hard smashes. Fruitless, frustrated smashes. Those of a man suffering the knife cut of tragedy. You sit there crying. The broken, harsh sobs of a man who knows that men can't cry. But do. Outside, the night dissolves into dawn. Once again, 8 million players prepare the new act of the human comedy. For you, a life has ended. A play is finished. And from deep within the sphere of your sorrow, a memory has been born. This is the story, Detective Shevlin. It happens to you. And produced by Rod Serling. Direction, Charles Lammers. Next week, another story out of the lives we lead. A girl, a love affair, a tragedy. You live it next week when it happens to you. ¶¶
There you go. Wonderful tale. With a tragic ending.
Wow. That tugs at the heartstrings. Hello? The $5 tissue affair.
He just, probably music for this moment somewhere.
No. Better not.
Yeah, no, I got to. I've got
to.
No.
Okay.
Oh, there it goes.
The great John Williams.
Johnny Williams.
Excuse me. You know, Mark, we have a tradition here before we get into some interesting stuff about yourself that we'd like you to share with us. We do have a little tradition around here that Gar created quite some years ago on the show. And we always have a moral of the story. Erie House Radio.
A little fractured fairy tales there, huh?
Yep. Erie House Radio proudly presents a Garless Gar's Moral of the Story.
With apologies to Gar, the problem with a boomerang, if you don't catch it, it becomes an offensive weapon. That finishes it up.
So much for tradition.
Yeah. One more quick thing about Rod, I guess, because you got to know Richard Matheson pretty well. Mm-hmm. How did he work with Rod?
Oh, he adored him.
How well did he?
Richard was one of the sweet, wonderful people of the world. Very soft-spoken, had a really sneaky sense of humor. He'd hit you with it. It would come in always underneath. But Richard got along. He was, you know, some of his best friends were Charles Beaumont, Harlan Ellison, Robert Bloch. You know, and as Richard was part of that whole group of Southern writers that they called the group that met at Ray Bradbury's house. And how'd you have liked to have been a fly on that wall? But Richard was he just was a really, really sweet guy. And I think in many ways the best writer of the group, you know. Rod's accomplishments were different than Richard. They were different kind of writers. And I think they were both great American writers. Not great American fantasy writers, not great American horror writers. Great American writers, period. I had great admiration for both of them, but Richard just thought the world of Rod. He just thought could not say enough good things about him and the association with him. Was amazed at how fertile the imagination was and just how generous he was with other writers. He giving credit. Rod always kind of undercut himself, was a very self-deprecating person. You know, Rod always, you know, he was very quick to put himself down in interviews and conversation. And I don't, you know, he once said that he didn't think that anything that he wrote would live 100 years after his death, you know. And well, we're more than 50 years after his death, and the stuff that he wrote has lived. And I think it's got a very good chance to make 100 and then some. So I think he was a very poor judge of his own writing.
I would agree.
No
and given the people that you've met and researched with and so forth, you had to have met, and I had the good fortune to meet him before he passed, but you had to have intersected at some point with Forrest J. Ackerman, no?
Oh, I did. No, I met Ackerman a couple of times. I was, you know, I didn't have the paths did not cross as well as they probably should have because, you know, they passed with a lot of people who crossed paths with him. You know, I ended up in the same place. As a matter of fact, you know, I was a guest at one of the famous Monsters conventions in Crystal City back in the 90s, and I debuted one of the Night Stalker there. So, you know, it's impossible not to sort of cross that path, but I interviewed him once, but, you know, I never sort of got the chance to do the deep dive with him that I was able to do with people like Richard Matheson. And, you know, I was much more fortunate in like Christopher Lee. I mean, I got to interview Christopher Lee like 3 or 4 times, and they were very long conversations and very deep conversations. Same with Vincent Price. And so I was able to, I have no complaint coming to what I say, because, you know, if I was to make a list of the people I did get a chance to do very long interviews with and get to know a little bit, it would be it's a very nice list. I have no complaints.
So what are you working on now?
Well, I'm jealous.
The next book is actually going to be out on Valentine's Day. So the publication date is February 14th, and it is a biography of Edgar Allan Poe. And so I sort of go back to the headwaters of a lot of this stuff. And it's the name of the book is A Mystery of Mysteries, The Death and Life of Edgar Allan Poe. And the reason it's called that is because it examines his life through the mystery of his death. We don't know how Poe died. We don't know under the circumstances under which Poe died. It is still one of the great, great mysteries. Poe dies under circumstances which reflect the two greatest accomplishments of his literary life. He left us a mystery, and he created the modern detective story, and he left us with a horror story because he died under circumstances which would not be out of place in one of his own horror stories. So we have this enduring mystery about Poe. And the thing about Poe, you know, the similarity, since we're talking about Rod Serling, I'll say this. One of the reasons I wrote the book, there is one great similarity between Rod Serling and Edgar Allan Poe, and that is everybody thinks they know who they are. If I say Rod Serling to you, you immediately have an image of Rod Serling, the guy with the clipped tones, with the cigarette, talking in front of the Twilight Zone and introducing each episode.
Yes.
And you know an idea of how, well, he didn't really talk like that. He only talked like that on screen. He didn't talk like that with his family. That was just, you know, something he adopted as a narrator of the Twilight Zone. Roger, would it surprise you if I told you that Rod Serling was a great practical joker, that he liked to stand on his head in restaurants, that he loved to play practical jokes on his friends, that he loved to imitate a gorilla, that one of his great impersonations was being able to impersonate a gorilla? This is not who you think of when I say Rod Serling.
No.
Rod Serling was this wonderful, devoted family man who loved his children, loved dogs, you know, loved his friends. There's a whole person that you think you know Rod Serling because you know the stereotype. You know the guy standing in front of the Twilight Zone, and that's our image of who Rod Serling is. And it's the same thing with Poe. Poe has come down as a stereotype, and we don't really know who the real writer is. So one of the things I wanted to do with this book was bring back Poe as the real person, the real writer, and who he was and who that person was created. And one of the things I did was I did interviews with people who could tell me that. And one of the group of people I went to were horror writers. So I went to Stephen King and Anne Rice and Robert Bloch and Ray Bradbury and horror directors like Wes Craven and Vincent Price. And I asked them, why was Poe good at what he did? It's not because he was the stereotype, the guy up in the attic with the wide eyes, drinking cognac with a raven perched on his shoulder and a black cat at his hand. That's not who he was. He was a really careful writer and a really careful craftsman, and there's a reason he was so good at what he did. And the reason wasn't because he was this goth figure that we've made him into. You know, we've sort of made him into this guy we put on T-shirts and we put on different things. And that's great because it's kept him alive. It's kept him, you know, everybody knows who Poe is. And everybody thinks they know who he is even as a writer. I've had so many people say to me, when they find out I'm doing this book, I love Edgar Allan Poe. I've read everything he's written. And I don't say it, but the smart aleck part of me wants to say, really? You've read all 17 volumes of works? Because if I did say that, they'd look at you like, what are you talking about? Well, Poe only lived to be 40. Serling died at 50. Poe died at 40. And by 40, he had written enough to fill 17 volumes worth of works. And very little of it is horror or mystery. Very little. And so when people say they've read everything, they mean they've got one of those collections, the complete tales and poems of Edgar Allan Poe, and they've read that. And that's you aren't even starting with Poe when you get there, you know.
If I
and
can
yes,
interject quickly, are you touching on the fact that he was something of a columnist. He was a critic. He critiqued other writers' work as well. Are you touching on to of that, including in all the things you researched on his written work?
Not only touching on it, you have to understand that in his lifetime, Poe was best known as a critic. He was, you know, Poe viewed himself as a poet and then as an author of mystery and horror tales third. Modern view of Poe has reversed it all. We think of him first now as an author of mystery and horror tales, a poet second, and a critic third. But in his lifetime, the American public knew him first as a critic. And such a stern and exacting critic that his nickname was the Tomahawk Man, because his standards were so high. He was one of the few critics who was holding American literature up to the highest possible standards, because he believed we could be that good, and he made a lot of enemies.
So he was Gordon Ramsay before way before Gordon Ramsay, from the sounds of it.
Not personally, because Poe viewed himself as a gentleman. Poe viewed himself as a Southern gentleman. And so he was, although he did have a lot of feuds. He did have, there were a lot of, Poe was as self-destructive as they came. You know, if Poe could make the wrong move at the wrong time, he made it. You know, and there are times where you want to reach into the back into Poe's life and slap him and say, what are you doing? This guy's trying to help you. Don't do this.
Come over here, Edgar. Come here, Edgar. I got five ideas. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'd like to put across you. Here, come here, Edgar.
Walk into this. You know, I mean, this is Poe. You know, it's time and time again. He pulls the rug out from under himself.
Forgive me. I'm totally gushing here because I am a huge Edgar Allan Poe fan. No, I haven't read all 17 volumes of his work, but I have read stories. I've read poetry. I very, very lightly touched on some of the critiques that he did. But I was just wondering, in your book, and I'm going to get on the real dark side here, he had some, how can we put this delicately? If everyone is familiar with Jerry Lee Lewis and the first person he ever married,
Edgar
Allan kind of did
that. 13-year-old cousin.
That's the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, his wife, Virginia, was not only his first cousin, so his aunt became his mother-in-law and his aunt at the same time. She was 13 at the time. And there's no question there's an ick factor to this. However, the two things that you have to kind of understand is, first off, Poe was trying to create a family, not so much a marriage. He was afraid he was going to lose his aunt and his first cousin, who represented stability in a household to him, to another cousin who had offered to take them in. And he panicked. And, you know, so, you know, he probably was looking for an aunt and in some ways a sister. He referred to her as Sissy. He referred to her as, and he undertook her education. He was absolutely devoted to her, but it was probably, you know, and nobody knows, because a lot of what we know about Poe is speculation, and you can only go so far. But you know, it probably was not a sexual relationship until later,
was
until
it even
Virginia
legal?
Was more mature.
I mean, I know people
marriage between cousins and marriage between was not as icky to that time as it was to us.
I got to get my hand sanitizer for a second here. Hang on.
However, Poe probably was sensitive to it because he faked the marriage certificate. He put her age as 17 on the marriage certificate. Probably was aware of, this is pushing a few boundaries here. But if you're asking, there's no way you cannot cover that aspect of Poe's life in the book. There's no way you can't, it's like the drinking. You cannot get around that Poe had a drinking. How much did he drink? We don't know. But there were long periods of sobriety. There were long periods. He was not drinking all the time. And we also know that it took very little to get him drunk. He was one of these people who one drink and it had the effect of like 10 drinks when he took a sip of alcohol. He was allergic to it. So he how much Poe actually drank is up for debate. But we know that there are long, long periods when he's not drinking. He could not have produced that much work of that much quality had he been drinking all the time.
Right.
I guess so. Well, I don't know. I mean,
on some high functioners, boy.
Yeah. I mean, Hemingway was not exactly known to put down the bottle. I mean, he did have a good work ethic per se, but he did pour down the booze.
Alcohol and the American writer is a constant theme. You know, Pete Hamill, the journalist and author, wrote a book called The Drinking Life, and he talks about how alcohol is a continuing curse that runs all through American literature. That some of our greatest writers were alcoholics. You know, certainly Hemingway, Sinclair Lewis, Eugene O'Neill, you can go on and on. Some of our Faulkner, they all had a problem with the bottle. And so Poe is not the first or last. In Poe's case, we just don't have good evidence for how much he drank. We just don't have very good evidence for how much and why. You know, because again, he was, unlike Hemingway, who had a fierce capacity for drinking a lot of alcohol all the time, which didn't do him very much good, Poe, on the other hand, could not tolerate it. He had a very low tolerance to alcohol. It still became a problem. It doesn't matter because it's still a problem.
And in your book, in your book, will you touch on what you think the most viable theory is to how he died? Because there are so many, there's tons of theories out there, but I'm just wondering with all the research you've done, that is something.
As a matter of fact, one of the people I interviewed for this book was a fellow by the name of Patrick Hensma, who is the leading forensic pathologist, one of the leading forensic pathologists in the country. I also interviewed John Douglas, who is the pioneering FBI profiler, who was the model for the Scott Glenn character in Silence of the Lambs. So I brought in the FBI and a forensic pathologist among my experts in this book to study Poe's death. And do I have a favorite theory? Yes. Can it be proven? No. I'm very clear about, that this is a cold case that has to remain in the area of mystery because we don't have any surviving soft tissue. We do not have surviving. There was no autopsy. Even if there had been an autopsy, they didn't know how to perform autopsies back then. They would have been performing them with meat cleavers and butcher's axes because, we did not get good at autopsies until the Civil War.
My preferred method.
The Civil War was this period where doctors learned how to perform autopsies. So we have very bad evidence, and we also have unreliable witnesses. People who changed their stories about Poe's last day 4 or 5 times. We have a parade of unreliable witnesses. So there's a lot of reasons why it has to remain a cold case. But do I have a favorite theory? Do I think there's a primary suspect? a person of interest in all of this? Or not a person of interest, but a mechanism of interest? Yes, I do. And I'm not going to say what that is until the book comes out, obviously.
Right. Now,
oh, no.
When that comes,
no.
Now, when it comes out, when it comes out, we're going to have to bring you back again, Mark.
Well, please. Yes,
you know,
please.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Like I always say, I'm a tough guest. You just have to ask me.
Now, one of the things you do, we still have a couple minutes left. I know when Dale mm-hmm. told his wife that you were going to be on the show, her first reaction was, not only all this stuff you've written and done, but oh, the Mark Twain guy. How did you get hooked into that?
Oh, you know, Twain is my favorite writer, and I became a writer because of Mark Twain, and I fell under the spell of Mark Twain in high school, and five of my books are on Mark Twain. I have a whole life where it's interesting because my books are so schizophrenic. They really are. I mean, you put all my books out on the table and people, what's the common theme? I don't get this. And, you know, there are things I'm drawn to. I'm obviously drawn to stuff on the spooky side of the street. I'm drawn to Twain. But, you know, I've got a book of theater history, the Columbo book. There's a little bit of everything there. And, you know, I just pursue my interests. I just pursue, you know, my passions and interests. And Twain is always, but, I, you know, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to a major Mark Twain conference. And I've been doing, it's held every 4 years. It's an international conference. And there are people there who only know me as a Mark Twain scholar. I've had people run up to me and say in past conferences, I just found out that you write books about horror stuff. Or I just found out that you were a TV critic at the Cleveland paper. I thought you were a professor. Yeah. So I have this whole life. And then, of course, I perform as Mark Twain as well. So, you know, and that is kind of like a whole nother part of my life, you know, which is
And I saw a picture of you and Hal Holbrook together.
Right. Yeah. Hal was a dear friend for 35 years. Yeah, I'm still not kind of over Hal's loss. You know, I still kind of expect the phone to ring and hear his voice. And It was a very, very dear, close friendship. And one of the Twain books is dedicated to Hal. And, you know, we met in 1985, and it was just a very, very deep, enduring friendship.
That's fabulous.
Outstanding. Outstanding.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you, there's an old saying that, you know,
how
you're rewarded.
How do you know all these people? I only know Dave and Dale. That's it. I don't know anybody.
Nobody.
Well, there's two answers to that. One is I had a job which put me in the path of them. You know, I was a film and TV critic for 40 years. So, you know, that sort of put me in the path of a lot of these people.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt.
And the second thing is, you know, which I've always said, you know, is that I have always been rewarded for following my passions. I've always been rewarded for following my interest in different things. And they've led to people like Hal and Richard Matheson and people like that. Listen, I'm in awe of it too. I sort of sit back and go, did that really happen? You know, did Richard Matheson really include me in the dedication to two of his books? Did that really happen? You know,
wow.
I'm as much staggered by that as anybody, you know? So, I've been unbelievably fortunate in being rewarded for following my interests and my passions. And I'll be the first to tell you that.
A kid from New York who spent a great deal of time in Northeast Ohio, you certainly do have a lot of connections in that realm.
Yeah. I mean, it's some person from Northeast Ohio we didn't even mention is Harlan Ellison, who was a very close friend for 30 years. And
okay.
As a matter of fact, we're doing a tribute to Harlan in September in Cleveland.
Oh, you might hear. Do you know that caller, Tim, that called in earlier, Mark?
I'm sorry, I don't. Which one?
Tim Aaron was one of the folks who joined us in the studio. He was a guest earlier. Just recently wrote some dark fantasy books, and he just had a foreword by Ellison in his book. He messaged me a little while ago, and he really holds you in high regard.
Well, that's very nice. Yeah, and like I said, we could do a whole show on Harlan. We could do a whole, you know, evening on just Harlan stories, because you could not know Harlan Ellison for that long and not have a trunk full of Harlan stories, and each will be one more outrageous than the last. And I got them.
Normally, we would Vincent Price take us out of here, but the clock is running down as far as the live show. Now, if you want to chat a little bit longer, the program will continue to record, but it'll no longer be live in about 5 seconds. So, folks, thanks for joining us here on Erie House Radio with special guest Mark Dubinjak. There we go. Timed that pretty well.
Okay.
Phew.
Wow, what an amazing 2 hours that was.
Went by like...
It went by far too fast.
Yeah, and they always do. I was going to tease
I learned stuff.
That's okay. If you learn something, I didn't mean it. You know, it was totally by accident. I was going to tease the Harlan thing by saying one of the stories includes a breaking and entering story. So, you know, talk about Harlan, that would be a lot of fun. And Harlan's niece lives in Cleveland still, Harlan's closest living relative is his niece, Lisa, and she still lives here in Cleveland. And she's
terrific. Is he from Cleveland originally?
Yeah.
Is he from the area?
Yeah.
I did not realize that.
Harlan was born in Cleveland. He grew up at the age of 7 or 8. The family moved to Painesville, and he spent like 5 extraordinarily unhappy years in Painesville because he was the only Jewish kid in Painesville, and he got beat up on a regular basis. So he moved back to Cleveland when he was about 13, and he was a runner for one of the mobs in Cleveland when he was a kid, and he ran away from home on a regular basis. He'd go to work on tuna boats in Galveston or go work in the coal fields of Carolina, and then he would come back. And so, he was born in Cleveland, and he did a lot of his growing up in Cleveland. And so Cleveland was the hometown.
We do have a saying here, all roads run through Cleveland.
Well, and that, you know, then Harlan was, you know, like I said, he never, you know, people would say that he was a Painesville native, and he would always quickly correct, say, no, Cleveland native. I was born in Cleveland, you know, and
everybody says, I'm sorry. That's too bad.
Harlan once came back to Cleveland around 2005 or thereabouts. Because I was in Los Angeles, and we went out to dinner, and Harlan says, listen, I need to ask you something. I said, what? He said, I need a photographer. And I said, what do you need a photographer for? He said, I need a photographer in Cleveland, and I need it because I want a very special picture. I said, well, what do you need? Tell me what you need, and I'll try to recommend somebody. Well, what he wanted was a picture of himself looking down at the graves of his parents who are in the Jewish cemetery around Beechwood. Mm-hmm. He wanted a picture of him looking down. And the way he said it to me is he said, I want my Bruce Wayne picture. You know, meaning.
I get that.
Yeah.
I get
you
that.
Got it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes,
got
looking
it.
Down
yep.
at
got
the
grave
of the parents. Right. So, you know, he eventually settled on a photographer, but the day he came in, it was a winter day, it was February, and we were in the middle of a blizzard. And we had dinner out of all places, the Red Lobster in Parma. Because Harlan loved Red Lobster. Don't
wait a
know
minute.
Why, but he loved Red Lobster.
Wait a minute. What city was that?
Uh-oh.
Parma.
Uh-oh.
Did you
Here
say
comes.
Parma?
Uh-oh.
Oh, all right. And somebody else's. Sorry about that.
That's all right. I got all those stories from Tim Conway at one point. The next day he went, but it was all snowing. So he finally got his pictures. He got his pictures, but he had to take a snow shovel out to dig the graves out because the gravestone was so encased with snow. And he got it really is amazing. He sent me the picture. I've got it. He sent me the resulting picture, which we used with his obituary in The Plain Dealer when he died, because it was such an amazing shot. But that was what he called his Bruce Wayne shot. You know, so that's why I say when he comes back to Cleveland, it really does come back to Cleveland.
Yeah.
So that's,
wow.
Some of us never.
That's
leave.
Amazing.
So yeah, and. You know, the other thing that I always loved about Harlan and I had something we would do for each other. Every time I would go out to visit him, Harlan would always say to me, bring somebody up to the house you think I should know, and I'll do the same thing. So, like, every time we would get together, you know, at his house, which was this amazing house up in Sherman Oaks, called the either Ellis in Wonderland or the Lost Aztec Temple of Mars, depending on what day it was. But Harlan had this amazing house he built, and he was constantly adding onto the house, and he would add on secret doorways and secret passages and towers and gargoyles, and, you know, and he had a whole front of the house which looked like an Aztec temple. And it had Martian symbols all over it, so it was called the Lost Aztec Temple of Mars. Very distinctive house. You knew it looked like no other house. And whenever you took somebody up to that house, it was like going to it again for the first time. It was like whenever you introduced somebody, you was like seeing that house through your own eyes again, all over again. So I would bring up friends, writer friends, and he would introduce, you know, somebody like J. Michael Straczynski or Josh Olson. He would have somebody over. And that was always kind of our reciprocal plan was Harlan met a whole bunch of people he really enjoyed getting to know, and I got to know people I really enjoyed getting to know. So, you know, there's, like I said, lots of stories about Harlan.
You know? Wow. And, we'll definitely have to do a Harlan Nelson night coming up.
Sounds like you've got a lifetime of things that you can write about to keep you busy a long time, too, and we certainly hope so.
Well, I don't mean to be in any way morbid about anything, but I'm going to be 66 on my next birthday. You know, and at 66, you start to think about, you know, time being a little bit more finite than it
used to. Well, you do at 62, you know? Especially.
So, you know,
when
you smoke
like Rod Serling, you know, it's.
Well, you know, when I was in my 30s, I thought, you know, there would be infinite time to write every book. Why not? You know, you always have time to write, you know, every book that you want to write. And then when you get to the point, you realize sooner or later it's going to become about the books you don't write instead of the ones you do. Sooner or later, you're going to get to the point where you can say, I've only got so much time and so many books left. And, I mean, that's not really being morbid because I really am, you know, hey, listen, you know, if it all stopped today, I'm way ahead of the game. You know, I've had more opportunities and blessings, and, you know, I'm the one who has no right to complain about anything. You know, so
that's a great, 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 refreshing way to look at it.
Are you still a critic with The Plain Dealer, or is that done?
No, that was over 2 years ago. When The Plain Dealer got rid of all of their union employees in April of 2020, you know, I was one of the people who was led. That put the kibosh on a 43-year journalism career. That brought it. I thought I was going to get maybe two more years of it, and I'd be sort of leaving the business about now. But that plan changed. You know,
was it a scary thing when you found yourself without the job with all that you've done and written, and I'm sure ideas that you had that you were going to write? Was any kind of trepidation at all at that time?
Yeah, maybe I'm too stupid to be scared. I don't know. when it happened. Well, let me put it this way. One thing is, when it happened, when it occurred 2 years ago, I was 63, going on, you know. So I am now 65, going on 66. So 2 years ago, I was 63, going on 64. It wasn't that scary because at that point, no matter how you do the math, at that point, you're not quite at the clubhouse, but your clubhouse is in view at that point. It did not happen to me when I was
43.
You're
on the 17th or 16th hole.
Right. You can smell the hot dogs. It's not, you know, it's, you're not there quite yet, but, you know, you start, and I didn't have to protect that many more years of working, you know.
Yeah.
And also, at this point, I was very fortunate. I mean, you guys want to listen to this? I mean, this is
sure.
Just kind
absolutely.
Of, all right. All right. In 2019, a small publisher in Southern Ohio, Commonwealth Books, convinced me that there should be a reprint of the Columbo book. And I said, I really don't think there are that many sales left in that book. You know, that book was published in 1989. It had a huge print run. It's, you know, but he said, but the prices are going way up on that book for on Amazon and eBay. The people who bought them are holding on to them, and that has driven the prices up. So a new edition, and I said, man, I was very unenthusiastic about the whole thing. And they kept coming after me about it. So finally I said, okay, you can reprint the book under one condition. I have nothing to do with it. I don't have to lift a finger. Very busy. I just don't have time. And they said, fine, that's good. They were going to do a facsimile reprint of the book, but then me being me, I got back in touch with them and said, yeah, you need a new preface on the book to sort of explain what it is, and I'll write you a new preface. And then a few weeks later, I called them up and said, you know, when Peter died, I did a remembrance of Peter. I could flesh that out. We could put that at the back of the book so you'd have something new at the beginning. Okay, that's good, good, too. And then I called them up a few weeks later. Yeah, you know, a lot happened between that book. Now I should do a new appendix for the book. At the end, I wrote like 10,000 new words, and they had to call me up and say, you got to snap, because if you send us one more word, you're going to send this book over and the page count over, and we're going to have to charge more for it. I said, okay, I'm done. Well, that book was published in the early December of 2019, just a few months before the Plain Dealer got rid of everybody. And the next day it was number one on Amazon on Books on Books on Television. And for the next 2 years, that thing sold so unbelievable. It was paying off like a slot machine every month. And so all of it, thank goodness they talked me into it, because it made the difference. The royalties I made off that book and the advance that I got off the Poe book almost at the exact same time, that's what got me through these 2 years, you know. It couldn't. It, for me, I was very. Once again, I was very fortunate. I have no complaint. I mean, I felt bad for my colleagues who were in their early 40s and 50s, who had to reinvent themselves, had kids in college. You know, I mean, for us, we kind of looked at the house is already paid for, the cars are paid for. You know, we were in pretty good shape. You know, overall, I others were not. You know, there were so many others.
Let me ask you an opposite question of this then. You enjoyed being a television critic. Would you still be doing it if you could?
You know, not with the way journalism became. I love being a newspaper critic in the 1980s and 90s. And newspapers were printing money in the basement. We had so much budget. We had an ability to do the job at such a high level. I mean, I tell when I used to teach at Kent State, I used to teach my kids this and say, you know, I know you think this is the oldest old fart in the world up here talking about the good old days, but let me tell you about the good old days. And then you tell me that they weren't the good old days. So the first thing I'm going to tell you is when I walked into the Akron Beacon Journal in 1983, I was handed a personal travel budget of $16,000. Let me say that one more time for those of you who did not hear it. $16,000 as a travel budget. I said, and that's 1983 dollars. I I couldn't spend it all. I tried. I was taxi cabs everywhere. I was grabbing every dinner check there was. I wasn't spending my money. I was spending Knight Ritter's money. And I was budgeted for four trips a year, $4,000 a trip, and it was impossible to spend that much back then. And so I said, you know, how many of you wouldn't mind starting a job that paid $16,000, you know, just to start with? You know,
back then, that was a good buck.
Yeah. So I said, you know, That's how good things were. And then, you know, I tell them about the rest of us. I got to experience journalism at a time. Another way that I was very fortunate, when it was a really great business to be in. But once you got into the 2000s and things just kept being diminished every year, it became less fun. It became a less fun place to work. It was still a great run. You cannot tell anybody that you watch television for a living and make that sound bad. You try that. Try to make that sound bad, you know. You can't.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time, man.
You know, you can't. You know, I actually used that in the Twilight Zone book where I said, you know, that for one of the lessons, the guest lesson, one of the essays, I talk about, you know, appreciating what you have and how sometimes it's all a matter of perspective. And I had a lot of colleagues, friends who were TV critics who used to complain about being TV critics. And I always said in my mind, whenever I heard that, I would go to some mythical bar, Cleveland, where I was sitting between two hulking out-of-work steel workers. Yeah. And they're looking down at me. We're all drowning our sorrows like Bogart in Casablanca. And they're looking down at me like, well, what's your problem? And Mike look up at them and say, my problem? I'll tell you what my problem is. I have to watch television for a living. That's my problem. And then they look down at me and they say, do they pay you for that? I said, yeah, the bastards pay me, and the check clears every week. And that's a one-way ticket. It's a one-way ticket to the parking lot to get your ass kicked. You know, and you deserve
that. I was
going
to say.
If you're complaining about this, you deserve to have your ass kicked, you know. So
yep.
I didn't complain about it then. I don't complain about it now, you know. So, but I do think that with streaming and everything else, it was a good time to get out.
I want to get paid to surf the internet. I'm getting paid to surf the internet.
Right.
In my pajamas. I wish.
Well, you know, and the thing that became difficult about the job was just keeping up with it because, you know, every year more people were committing television. And, you know, by the time I quit with streaming services and everything else.
Oh, yeah.
It was just trying to keep up with it was next to impossible. So, you know, I think I left at a good time. And I think in some ways they did me a favor because I've been able to concentrate on writing books and
consider that, you know, they won't even send, you know, a sports writer to cover the Guardians when they play in Detroit, you know, which is just a few hour drive away.
Right.
It's crazy.
Oh, yeah. And that was the last cut. Yes. Because sports got travel budget when everybody else's travel budget was wide. They always kept it for sports. And then gradually that got, you know, it just, like I said, it was always, every year was diminishing returns with this business. And so I think I got out at probably a good time. And I certainly was fortunate to get 43 years out of it. You know, and they were 43 mostly pretty good years. So, once again, that's one more thing where I don't get any right to come. But hey, listen, they're putting dinner on the table. I got to run. So
hey, thanks for joining us
so much.
And
thank you so much. It's just an absolute pleasure having you back again.
Whenever you wish to reconvene, I'll pick a topic and off we'll go. You know,
that's great.
Well, you know what? Since you are the special, CW usually does this, but since you're the special guest, you get to call in Jimmy Durante to close out our show for us tonight.
Please do.
Good night,
please.
Miss Alabama.
There you go.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
It's time to say good night. Good night. What more to say but good night? We've had a few laughs, and it's time for toodaloo. Arrivo, up we the same, and ink-a-tink-a-doo. Good night. Good night.
Good night, folks. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Wherever.
Do you mind turning off the radio?